The world's best don't get results alone, and now neither do you, no matter when, where, or what you're working on. Introducing Pit Stop's AI Avatar Marketplace. Think of it like Spotify, but for personal and professional growth. Imagine instant access to digital versions of the world's top coaches, each one trained on their unique methods, experience, and coaching style. This isn't just another chatbot. Every Pit Stop AI avatar is powered by real coach insights, their notes, their podcasts, and what they've learned from real sessions. It's a truly personalized coaching companion, so much smarter and more relevant than generic tools like ChatGPT. Whether you want to level up in business, build new habits, manage stress, or boost your confidence, you're not just getting advice, you're getting it directly from the playbook of proven high achievers, all at a fraction of the cost of traditional coaching and available 24/7 whenever you need that extra edge. Ready to find the coach that you need? Use Pit Stop as your launchpad for growth. Head to the link in the show notes and download the app now.
Welcome to Drive to Thrive, a Pit Stop podcast. My name is Sandy and I am your host, and I am joined this week by Dr. Richard Blake. Richard is a researcher in the psychology space. He is a breath work expert, aka the Breath Geek on Instagram. And he joined us to talk all things transformation, how we can transform our mind and body and where we should start. And as he says, we should always start with our body, telling us about the importance of breath work, the importance of staying true to yourself and working hard, you know, giving the example of his dad and finding enjoyment in work and finding a purpose with that and not feeling like you need to conform to what everybody else is doing. One of the biggest things we talked about is therapy and why such a huge percentage of men quit therapy even after just the first session. Almost half men quit after the first session. Is talking really addressing the root cause that men are struggling with, and what are the alternatives? And as Richard says, often it actually comes down to doing things like breath work. We talked about mine and the founder of Pit Stop, Emmett's experience on a men's retreat doing breath work and how that really helped. And then, of course, finally getting into how we can optimize our breathing and whether we should be thinking about things like nose strips and mouth tape while you're sleeping. A really, really informative conversation. Lots of great statistics, lots of great insights into how we can optimize and improve ourselves and think twice about whether we actually need to go to therapy and try and find some alternatives that can really help us. Please enjoy our conversation with Dr. Richard Blake. Richard Blake, welcome to the podcast. Thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Sandy. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you on. Let's dive straight in. Something I read on your various pieces of content and, you know, your website and all this stuff is the idea of transforming your mind and body. Where should we start with that, the mind or the body?
I think the body is probably a better place to start. Firstly, because, well, as you may have known from the intro, like, I have a PhD in psychology, but I'm also extremely interested in the body and the foundation for mental health in the body. I saw a funny, it was a meme, it was supposed to be clever. It was a video of a marathon, I think it was somewhere in Europe, and there was a load of men running by, and then there was a smug looking woman holding up a board saying therapy was also an option. And, you know, this is the kind of thing, they make fun of men for doing things like running marathons, climbing Everest, instead of like focusing on their problems. And what that woman probably doesn't know is that exercise is three times more effective than therapy on the Hamilton scale for depression. So I think, yeah, if we don't have our physical health, then we've got nothing really. And more we're learning about how the body affects the mind. You know, there's that old saying, but now we're getting more research. A study came out this week showing that probiotics significantly reduced symptoms of schizophrenia. So, you know, extremely strong evidence for something that is, you know, an extremely severe condition that can be helped just by changing someone's gut bacteria. Similarly, we're finding more and more that inflammation is the root cause of a lot of mental health issues like anxiety and depression. And so, yeah, if we're living a completely inflamed life, we're eating a load of trash, we have, we're completely sedentary, no amount of talking about your childhood is going to solve that. Only, you know, eating healthy and getting out in nature and exercising is gonna heal that root cause.
Yeah, I love that. I saw that meme as well. I saw the therapy thing. I like that you kind of hit back at that a little bit. It's an interesting one, and it's something that I've been told as well. You know, is jumping in. You know, moving when you're kind of at your lowest and you don't know where to turn or anything. Someone very wise once said, just always start with your body. And I think one of the points that he made as well was like, often we think about it, and you just provided the perfect example there. We think about when we want to go and do this, we think we have to go and run a marathon, right? Or we have to go and climb up a huge hill, or we have to go and lift as heavy weight as possible. But I imagine, you know, from your background and in the psychology, why do we feel like we have to go to those extremes? Why and how can we kind of readjust ourselves to realize that actually sometimes you don't need to do that? You literally just need to go for a walk outside for 30 minutes.
Yeah. So I think a lot of people have self-esteem issues. I think a lot of men are lacking purpose. And so they're trying to manufacture purpose. I've done that many times. Like I started out as a fitness model. My goal was to get into men's health from about age 14. I eventually did that. I climbed that mountain and then was even more depressed afterwards. So it was a nice distraction for a while. And I thought, oh, once I achieve my goal, I will be free of these mental health issues. But I certainly wasn't. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't use tasks, quests, endeavors to keep us going, to give us something motivated for. I'm also really a fan of the Misogi. Have you heard of the Misogi challenges?
No, I haven't.
So this is from a great book, one of my favorite books called The Comfort Crisis. And they suggest people do Misogis once a year. So it's a Japanese concept where you pick a task that you're about 50%, you have about 50% success chance or probability of succeeding. So one example is like Cameron Haynes. He picks up a really big rock and tries to take it to the top of the hill.
Yeah.
And it's like a really big rock, right? It's something that he, you know, most people can't do, and often, you know, he can't do. Or it's like so my podcast co-host, he just did a 50 miler, you know, an ultra marathon, and he was like, I haven't trained that much, I haven't run a marathon in years. My goal is just to finish a marathon and then see if I can do the second marathon. And he got to 40 miles and he was like, he was delighted. Like he failed the 50, but he sensitized himself to this idea of failure. And this is what shows up in a lot of the research on the Gen Zs and Gen Alphas that are failing a lot, or struggling a lot, you know, with their mental health, is they're really sensitive to rejection because of, well, snowplow parenting and helicopter parenting, where just all challenges have been removed from them from a young age. So they just don't get used to regulating themselves when they fail. So I think for everyone, especially young people who have, you know, been robbed of that chance to struggle, we should struggle. We should look for struggles. We should look for things that we're going to fail at, and then develop the tolerance and the skill set to manage our emotions when we inevitably face failure.
And I guess as well, in terms of that failure, kind of repeating what I said just earlier, those failures don't have to be catastrophic, do they? You know, they don't have to mean trying a job and failing and losing it, or, you know, even just like, you know, going and asking someone out and getting rejected. It can literally be something as small as like you're a smaller version of your friend deciding to run 50 miles and only running 40. You know, it's like you only need to do these kind of tiny things every day, like little failures every day. Kind of tend to stack up. I suppose I've got two questions in there. Firstly, for any kind of parents listening, can you go into what you described earlier there, the kind of helicopter parenting, things like that? How can they kind of pull back a little bit more? And really interesting, I was listening to a podcast the other day. It was Ben Affleck on Theo Vaughn's podcast, and he was talking about exactly this, about how hard he's, you know, found it as a celebrity as well, and someone with all the means in the world, to really ensure that his kids are still having the stumbling blocks put in place. Can you go through, you know, what parents can do and kind of where they can kind of find that balance a bit?
Yeah. So there's that saying, prepare the child for the road, not the road for the child. So, you know, instilling practices and ways of being in children that, yeah, set them up for life's mm-hmm. challenges. Because, yeah, I have a men's group, two men's groups. I've set up one in London, one out here in California, and it's called Struggle Well, from that concept from Ray Dalio. It's like everyone struggles. Life is not easy for anyone. The goal is just to struggle well. And I'm a big fan of Jonathan Haidt's work, all his books, but especially his most recent one, The Anxious Generation. And he talks a lot about gaming. And gaming seems to be making a lot of these mental health issues worse. And when I was gaming as a kid, I was playing mm-hmm. Super Mario Brothers with my brother. He was 6 years older than me. He would beat me really easily. I would throw the controller down, storm out of the room, but then I'd have to come back and see him and be embarrassed in front of him and make up and repair that conflict. Whereas kids now, they're playing with their headsets with strangers from all around the world. They're talking to each other in the most like rude, disrespectful, yeah. awful, awful ways. And then they just leave. They just ghost. They never have to repair. They never learn that skill like of going, oh, I've embarrassed myself here because I'm a bad loser. I never have to go and face the necessary guilt and shame of my actions. So they just, they develop these bad habits of being really rude to each other online and then not making up at the end. So, I mean, the more face-to-face interactions kids can have rather than online interactions, I think the better. Jonathan Haidt says we've completely over-sanitized the real world. You know, mm-hmm. kids aren't allowed to walk down the street age like 14 or whatever, like, but we've completely underprotected them in the online world. They're just, you know, exposed to the most awful content. They're on their screens way too much. They're just completely deficient in dopamine. And no one's really policing or patrolling their online lives, which is causing them to be, you know, anxious and ADHD and depressed and fragile. So, yeah, I think the more, as I say, like getting involved in like playing with the neighbors down the street, giving them more responsibility and freedom there, making sure they're not online as much, and also letting them be bored. Like, you know, our kids just don't get bored anymore. Like, the more bored kids are, the more creative they become, because like they're like, I'm bored. And if they go to their parents, I'm bored, and the parents like, okay, here's YouTube, just go on that for 8 hours. They don't learn to be creative, be like, oh, I'm bored, well, why don't I go, you know, make a fort out of these sticks, why don't I play with my Lego, why don't I create a game with my little brother, we'll invent the rules and we'll create this imaginary language. And yeah, all this creativity is like spurned from the necessity to entertain themselves.
Yeah, I consider myself, so I'm 33, so I'm very lucky. I'm in that kind of, I guess, like younger end of the millennials, where like social media entered my life when I was like 15-16, and it was like Bebo and MySpace and stuff, you know. So I'm quite lucky. I remember being like 8 years old and I had this dinosaur book. And I didn't have the toy dinosaurs, so I would trace pictures of the dinosaurs, and then I would play with the drawings that I'd made, and I drew this big thing. And I still, like, that's like a vivid core memory for me now that I did that. And I don't want to be that millennial, like, oh, back in my day, you know, and all this. But like, it is true, and I do think back to that, and it's kind of remarkable how sometimes my brain flashes back to those little bits of creativity as a kid, and they kind of, in a weird way, like fuel me now of what I'm up to now. And, you know, if I'm trying to think of an idea of work for work, or if I'm doing a podcast or anything like that, like even right now it's come to me, you know, and I think you're right. I think, you know, not having these in-person things, and it's what you said about purpose earlier. So many men lack purpose, but I think young men, boys as well, you certainly get to an age where you're like 12, 13, and like you also kind of want a purpose, and your hormones are like flying around going, what the fuck is going on here? And actually, you know, sometimes that purpose, sadly, at the moment does just become Fortnite or something else. And unless you're deeply embedded within a sport culture, and I think we've lost a lot of that as well, you know, rugby, football, or, you know, anything, you know, broader, I think it's really difficult for them to be able to kind of come back and do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really like this question. I've heard it on Chris Williamson. It's like, we know what we want, and we can choose what we want, but we need to choose what we want to want. So I can remember as a younger boy, I wanted to be a professional footballer. I was not good enough to be a professional footballer. Then I would get addicted to Championship Manager or Football Manager. But I knew there was no demand for any professional Championship Manager computer game players. So I really like thought to myself, like, if I want to be happy, I've got to find something the world wants, something that I'm good at, and that something's going to like keep me happy. So I hated work as a kid. As a younger man, I hated it. I remember going in for work experience and being like, oh my God, is this going to be my life in an office? This is unbelievably boring. I can't handle this. And so I tried, like, slowly over time, started training myself. Like, what can you do that the world actually wants? So I started learning a lot. I started reading a lot. Ferocious reader, reading journals, academic papers. And I learned to want to work, because that's what I saw my dad. My dad was like self-made man, very successful. He just loved to work. And like, when I see people who are like struggling, they just don't really enjoy what they're doing. And my dad, I can remember my uncle who didn't really understand my dad. He's they're brother-in-laws. And my uncle would be like, why don't you take your kids to see Chelsea? They're Chelsea fans. Why don't you go watch their sports games more? Why aren't you involved in all their lives more? And he wasn't involved like enough, a sufficient amount, but not compared to dads these days. Dads like driving their kids to basketball 5 days a week and football 5 days a week, and they're so involved in their lives. And my dad just said, the reason I don't do that is because it's like, I just love turning £1 into two. My hobby is making money.
Yeah.
And so if you're competing against someone like my dad, you are competing against someone who just absolutely loves what he's doing. He hated taking holidays. He would work like, he would be out of the house at 6 a.m., back at 7 p.m. He had his own company. He just wanted to work all the time. So of course he was going to be more successful than other people who worked less than him, because he was doing what he loved. He trained himself to love doing really boring stuff. He was a chartered surveyor, like boring real estate stuff. But he just trained himself to like this boring stuff. So he had the competitive advantage, not because he was much smarter than other people, he was smart enough, but because he just trained himself to want to work and to want to be, to do things that people wanted.
Yeah. It's really, are you familiar with Scott Galloway?
Yeah.
Yeah, so he has like a really interesting take on this as well. And it's something I've actually been thinking about quite a lot recently. And it's there's this whole adage on, you know, every podcast you listen to, and it's like, you know, find a job you love and you'll never work a day in your life and all this stuff. And he kind of has rephrased that and repackaged it a bit. And he's like, no. Don't find a job you love, like find a job you're good at. Because then once you realize you're good at it, like you said, you know, with your dad and things, you realize you're good at it, you then become obsessed with it. And then you, the byproduct of doing that is that you become successful. And then you enjoy that. And then actually, you can enjoy the life around your work a lot more. You can realize that you can take all your mates out to dinner, or you can take your partner on a holiday and you don't need to worry about it. And you become financially secure and you can look after your parents and you can do all this. And actually, the way he says it is like, actually, that leads to a more fulfilling life than the idea of loving what you do. And I think there's a lot of credence to that. You know, I think I saw something about Tom Holland, you know, the guy who played Spider-Man, everything like that. You look at him and you're like, oh, this guy's got everything, dream job and all this. And I saw an interview with him and he was like, still a job, mate. Still a job. I still have to sit there on set and wait for 8 hours to get called up and put this stupid suit on, and I'd rather be playing golf with my mates. Like, it's still a job. And we all still have to go out and do work. And I really liked what Scott Galloway said of actually don't, you know, like for sure, for me, like if I could have any job, like, yeah, maybe I'd be a, I don't know, professional surfer or whatever. But even then I watch documentaries and that looks awful as well. You know, I think it's just, I think it's not so much about finding something you love. I think it's finding something that you can improve at and that you're interested enough in that you can really get to that top level. And then suddenly you're going to start enjoying the rest of kind of life around you.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you'll get a lot of criticism along the way. A lot of people criticize my dad because they're like, why aren't you spending your money? Why aren't you going on more holidays? Why aren't you doing all these things that I want to do? And he was just like, I don't want to do those things. Yeah. And this is the reason he was successful. It's like, he had a phenomenal ability to like delay his gratification. He saved probably like 50% of his income. So he was like building for the future. And then he would get all this criticism from all these other people who had like, who weren't successful, and be like, oh, you should be living your life like me. I'm not successful, but I have more fun. And my dad's like, no, this is what I want. I'm yeah. extremely happy. He died a happy man. A lot of people would be like, oh, he never enjoyed the fruits of his wealth. He died completely satisfied and proud of his life.
That's
and
cool.
Similarly, like I, as I said, I consume ferociously. Like, I am listening to podcasts, audiobooks, I'm reading like all day long, and people will get annoyed at me, be like, why don't you not have podcasts on? Why don't you just like have silence? Why don't you just like watch more TV? Why don't you just like have more fun? I'm just like, because this is fun for me. I've turned it into fun. Like, my idea of fun is different from your idea of fun. And that's okay. And like, if I want to be successful, I want to be like, you know, invited to podcasts like I am. I need to be on top of all these things. I need to listen to podcasts. I need to be on the forefront of the latest research. Otherwise, I'm just like everyone else. I'm not that useful.
I think you start to realize as well with that kind of comparison thing, a lot of the time that stems from the other person's insecurities rather than actually your kind of behavior and things. Often, like, you're never going to get a reaction like that from someone who is operating on your level or above you. You're always going to get a reaction, like you said, you know, from someone talking to your dad. It's because they're not as successful. So they're, in a way, they may not even notice it, I guess. I mean, you're the psychology expert here, not me, but I'm just projecting maybe. But like, to me, that they're doing it because they're feeling like threatened and they don't feel as good about themselves. So they're trying to kind of pull you down to their level a bit. It's the tall poppy syndrome thing again, isn't it? It's like, hang on a minute, what are you doing out of your lane? Get back in your lane. You shouldn't be doing that, because then that makes them feel like, well, maybe I should be going and, you know, doing that thing.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think often when people come up against successful people, it's a reflection of their own their own state. And obviously, there's that saying, like, you'll never be criticized by someone who's doing better than you. Mm-hmm. Often the criticism is an attempt to get a leg up over you. And I think a lot of people just, they're dissatisfied with their lives. And they don't want to change their lives. They want the world to change for them. They want what they do to be what is in demand, and they don't want to have to change. But as I said earlier, like, for me, like, I had the most difficult transition from university to corporate life, where I realized, like, I can't just piss about and spend loads of time in the gym and playing Football Manager. Like, it took me like a year or even two to get my act together. And it was probably the hardest phase of my life. I was depressed. I was anxious. My self-worth was completely through the floor, because what I wanted to do didn't match the expectations of this corporate employer and what everyone else was doing. So I was struggling. I could have just gone, oh, well, they're all just corporate idiots and they're all pathetic for wanting to do a corporate job. But I had to adapt, and then, you know, I managed to fit in. So yeah, I think often it is a reflection. And like, I really like that saying from Naval Ravikant. It's like, you know, if you're so smart, why aren't you happy? Like, you can have an IQ of 150, but if you're not happy, then you can't really be consider yourself smart, because smart people change themselves. Smart people adapt to get what they want. But if you're just, you know, you just think you're smarter than everyone else, or which is really common now, you think the reason you're not successful is because you've been held back in some way because of your identity, your status, your lack of privilege. Like, the people who are successful, you know, there's so many examples of people who are successful despite having no privileges in any way, but they haven't just gotten caught up in their identity and just been like, well, that's a prison that I'm stuck in. They've realized they have to adapt and grow and rise above that.
What can people do if they're recognizing patterns within themselves that they are starting to kind of treat themselves like a victim? If that makes sense, you know, they are starting to look at themselves like, you know, and blaming these other things. What can people do to try and make themselves feel a bit more accountable and try and rewire those thought patterns so that they can, you know, take ownership of their lives a bit more?
Yeah, well, I think this is a really difficult one, because I think the people who are victims, nothing I can say is going to change their minds,
right?
Because this is, they are fed this stuff all over the place. They are fed like from mainstream media, from social media, everywhere is telling them the reason you're not successful is not because of your lack of effort. It's not because of your low IQ. It's not because you have low, not ideal traits on the Big Five personality. It's just because someone's held you back and you should just blame them. And then you'll just stay stuck there. I can only really speak to the people who want to take accountability, who want to take a look at themselves and go, well, how can I improve? What can I do to make myself better? Firstly, stop blaming anyone else other than myself, because as soon as you blame other people, you give them the power. Yeah, if you take responsibility, you can change yourself. You can't change the whole world, or maybe some people can, but chances are you're not going to be able to do that unless you change yourself first. So there are a lot of things people can do if they take responsibility. So, starting with good habits, turning your phone off at 8 p.m. like you do, getting a good night's sleep, getting sunlight, spending time in nature, not spending loads of time on news, reinforcing the worldview that, everything is screwed and you've got no chance, following the right people on social media who are going to build you up instead of keeping you small, exercising, eating well, meditating, doing breath work, doing ice baths, doing masogis, doing hard things, embracing challenge. There's so many things that can be done, but nothing can be done if you're just convinced that you're a victim and there's no hope for you.
Yeah, I really like that. I read something today that said, regarding what you said about the news there, I read something that's, it was like humans, we should only actually ever care for about 150 people or something like that in our lives. And that's how small our circle should be in terms of our, I suppose, like sphere of influence, but also like how far out we're putting ourselves. And because of the globalization of the world today and the news we consume and Twitter and or X or whatever it's called these days, or, going on Instagram and all this, you're just bombarded with so much. And it becomes so difficult to actually set aside what's truly important in front of you and what is just kind of in the ether. And then I think, that does, it comes back to, I say it on every podcast I do, but it comes back to the comparison thing. It's comparison is the thief of joy. And then I think it's so easy to sit in that comparison and then fall into the kind of victim thing of like, well, even if you've done something awesome, even if like, for example, for me, where I live in the UK, I go surfing almost every single day. And I'm like, even if I surfed, I'll go on Instagram and I'll see a video of someone in Indonesia surfing a better wave than me, and I'll be like, well, my day was shit. And actually, my day wasn't. My day was beautiful and I had a lovely time. But it's so easy to then go, well, maybe I shouldn't be living here. Maybe I should go and live in Bali. And maybe if I lived in Bali, I'd be connected with more people. And then it's cheaper there, so I could do that. And then you just go in this cycle. And before you know it, you're the opposite of grateful for everything around you.
Big time. Yeah, I totally second that. And a lot of people will say, on my comments on my Instagram feed, like the reason we're anxious is because we don't have enough money or we're broke or, income inequality. But then I look at the statistics and things, and mental health is inversely correlated with a country's GDP. So the UK has the sixth largest economy in the world, but the second worst mental health, the second most miserable country in the world is the UK. And poorer countries have better mental health. Some people say, oh, that's just because it's not reported as much. But I don't think that's the case. That's probably a part of the issue. But what happens in poorer countries and poorer families is they rely on each other. When you have wealth, you buy your independence. When when you're wealthy, you don't need to ask your neighbor to watch your kids. You pay for a babysitter. When you're wealthy, you pay for a taxi instead of asking your cousin to give you a lift to the airport. We need to rely on each other and we need communities. And, loneliness is a huge problem. The UK has a minister for loneliness now. Loneliness is equivalent to smoking a pack of cigarettes per day in terms of how bad it is for your health. And then another thing in terms of comparison is like, if like, obviously there are people who are extremely poor in the UK and, don't have enough and they have food insecurity and things like that. I'm not talking about them, but I'm talking about, let's say, like 80% of the population who have electricity, have enough to eat, have running water, have the internet. Those people will probably say, well, if I was, you know, instead of being in the 20th percentile, if I was in the 1%, I'd be happy. But those people in the 20th percentile and above, they have more wealth, power, and privilege than medieval kings and queens. Medieval kings and queens had food insecurity. If there was a famine, mm-hmm. they would probably go hungry. They didn't have electricity. They maybe had running water, but doubtful they had hot water. They certainly didn't have the internet. They certainly didn't have planes or cars or the ability to travel or communicate with people all around the world. So if you're going to compare yourself to Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, you're going to feel hard done by. But if you're going to compare yourself to like King Henry VIII, you've got a way better life than King Henry VIII.
Yeah. That's a good point. It goes both ways, the comparison thing. I think it comes down to like the gratitude thing again. You know, it's so easy. Like, again, people, regular listeners are going to be so fed up with this, but like, I have little yellow post-it notes around. This is an idea I got from Chris Williamson. I have them like dotted around my apartment. So I have one on the back of my bathroom door that says, nobody is thinking about you as much as you think they are. So like every morning I brush my teeth, and that sounds bad, but actually I think it's a really good thing. It's really freeing. It makes you realize that you can kind of go and do whatever you need to do and what you want and no one else cares. But I've got one when I wake up in the morning straight on the wall there, and it says, think of three things to be grateful for. And I think it's really important. And gratitude's a funny thing, and thinking about this stuff, I think it's so easy when people talk about gratitude that you've got to be like, my health and my family and my career and all this. And I think that's good, but I think it's so obscure to your daily life sometimes. So for example, like I do one and I read them out to my friend the other day and it was hilarious. Like one of them was like, I'm grateful because I've got a Coke Zero in the fridge. Like I'm grateful because I went surfing this morning. I'm grateful because I did my washing yesterday, so I don't need to do it today. Like it's like stupid little daily things like that. And actually for me, I realize I get to the end of a week and I read kind of my Monday to Friday, whatever, and I'm like, oh, it's not bad, is it? Things are all right. And I think by condensing the stuff down, I think it makes life a lot easier to kind of digest. And like you said, realizing that you've got it a bit better than Henry VIII.
yeah, absolutely. I think doing gratitude practices does rewire the brain. It does create neuroplasticity to seek out things to be grateful for instead of to complain and criticize about. And then just going back to that 150, the Dunbar number, I think I'm starting to look into more and more research that the mental health crisis is in part due to this concept of the symptom pool. Have you ever heard of the symptom pool?
No, I haven't.
Okay, so it's from a book. I read it from James Davis's book, Cracked, which is about like psychiatry and how it's, you know, not really doing what it's supposed to be doing. But it's the symptom pool is basically you'll develop symptoms based on ideas from other people's symptoms. So it's similar to like when I was a kid, I saw my brother like pretending to vomit to like not go to school. So then I started to like pretend to vomit when I didn't want to do things. I know kids do that a lot, right? I never got that idea until he got that idea. And he got that idea probably from some of his friends. And there's some really obscure ones like Koro. So Koro is this mental health condition that only occurs, I think, in this one small island in Southeast Asia. And it's where men develop a deathly fear that their genitals are going to go inside their body.
Oh.
Yeah. And it doesn't exist anywhere else. But obviously someone just developed this fear and then it just became contagious only to that island.
What?
No one else has this fear of their genitals going inside their body. Hopefully none of your listeners will develop this fear either. Similarly, something did happen in the UK, which was, basically the same thing. So when Princess Diana shared that she had bulimia, cases of bulimia skyrocketed in the UK. Some people will say, oh, that's because she destigmatized it and reported it more, which was a part of it. But then when she died, the cases went way back down. So that stigma had been removed. But as soon as she left, people were like, well, I can't be like Princess Diana, you know, one of the most famous and most loved people in the world. She's loved because she's got bulimia and she's a champion of this. I'm not getting enough attention. I'm going to get attention for being bulimic as well. Just like I wanted attention for vomiting, like pretending to vomit as a small child. So I think anxiety has become this symptom pool thing. Certainly some people's anxiety is legitimate. It's related to actual threats and actual PTSD and inflammation in the body and terrible diets. But I think a lot of people are just seeing, well, I'm not doing that well in the world. I can't succeed. So I'm just going to succeed in being the biggest victim. I'm going to create this anxiety disorder. I'm going to create this multiple personality disorder. There's a lot of like skepticism about whether or not multiple personality disorder is an actual thing. There's a lot of books saying it didn't exist until the 80s, and then it became a thing, and then people started copying it. So I think a lot of the rise in mental illness is due to people wanting mental illness, being vulnerable to the ideas of other people, and then running with it.
That's crazy, but it kind of makes sense. It's a tough one. Talk to me about therapy then. It's something we kind of spoke about just before we jumped on the call, and it's a huge part of kind of what you talk about on socials as well. There's this huge proportion of men who quit therapy, and go into it. I've done therapy myself. I've done it two times over the course of my adult life, in 2023, and then again at the start of 2024, and I did it for about 3 to 4 months both times. And it was good, but yeah, it got to the point for me where I was like, I need to go and do this by myself now. And I wonder, is that common? Is that what other men think? And then, you know, is it really addressing the root cause? I realize I've just asked you about 8,000 questions there, Rich, but yeah, go get into the whole therapy and men relationship for me.
Yeah. So, I'll tell you my story. So, I was studying psychotherapy at university, and after about 2 years of writing papers and looking at meta-analyses and seeing the efficacy of therapy, I was just getting really, really disappointed seeing, like, some suggest that talk therapy only has like an 8% success rate for addiction, and then a meta-analysis by Pim Kuypers showed it only has a 48% response rate for anxiety, and then another paper showing 48% of those people relapse within a couple of months. And then you look into dropout rates and attrition. So attrition is basically when you're conducting a study, people start the study but just don't finish it. So you don't use those numbers. So you say like 48% of people responded to the therapy, but maybe 20% of people just dropped out because it wasn't working. But you don't say, oh, those people don't drop out. You just don't include that data. Another study came out recently showing that 46% of men drop out of therapy prematurely, and 26% of those men drop out after one session. So nearly half of men drop out of therapy because it's not working and well enough for them. You then look at publication bias. So in academic journals are a little bit like newspapers. You know, they want headlines, right? They want therapy works amazingly. They don't want a study showing therapy does not outperform a placebo. Those studies just don't see the light of day because it's not in the financial interest of the journal. That's not saying like a conspiracy. That's just basic economics, right? So a lot of the papers that show that therapy doesn't work more effectively than a placebo, just not included. So we only ever see the successful ones. And if we're only seeing the successful ones and they're only at 48% and we're not including the attrition, we're not including the publication bias, the success rate for therapy must be much less. I think it's probably around 13, 14, 15%. So pretty weak, in my opinion. So I, at that time, was discovering conscious connected breathwork. I was training with my now mentor, Alan Dolan, at Breath Guru, and I was having phenomenal results with both my own personal growth and also the growth of the clients I was working with. And at that time, there was no research, really. Like, well, there's no high quality research. There wasn't any randomized controlled trials. So I quit my postgraduate certificate in psychotherapy. Sorry, I quit my master's, left with a postgraduate certificate in psychotherapy, transferred to California Institute of Integral Studies here in San Francisco to do a PhD in psychology and conduct a trial, a randomized controlled trial on conscious connected breath work. And yeah, but the results were phenomenal. It was the largest ever randomized controlled trial on this type of breath work. We had statistical significance. We had a large effect size and, you know, phenomenal qualitative data as well. You know, people having mystical experiences, people having life-changing reductions in anxiety. So my thing now is really about promoting conscious connected breathwork and also talking about to the people that therapy doesn't work for. I'm not suggesting that therapy doesn't work, because it does save lives, right? It just doesn't save enough lives, in my opinion. I think we need higher standards. I think we need more tools that include things like plant medicine, that include enough emphasis on exercise and reducing inflammation and keto diet and breath work. So also, I'm getting more and more concerned about the actual iatrogenic harms of therapy. So this is a concept from Abigail Schreer and Lawrence Patihis. Patihis is a professor at Portsmouth University. I've got him lined up for a podcast soon on our podcast. I'm very excited to talk to him. But he came up with this study last year. So his background is in like social psychology. He is often like doing research on memory for the legal system. So talking about how bad juries are effectively, and how bad like witness testimonies are because of the fallibility of memory. And then he also turned his attention to therapy and the malleability of therapy. And he did a study where basically a randomized controlled trial where they would just ask people to write about their childhood with like minimal suggestion. But they found that even with like minimal negative framing of questions, people would remember their childhood worse than it was. And the more they talked about their childhood, the worse it got. Without any of the circumstances changing, their memories, their recollection became darker. It became more likely to be like, oh, I had a bad childhood. I was abused. I was neglected. My mum's a narcissist. My mum's toxic. My dad didn't respect my boundaries. So he's suggesting that therapy should come with a warning label, just like, you know, when you go for a run, you know, you can sprain your ankle, right? Getting fit is still important. You should still go for a run. You should still try and get fit. Similarly with like anesthesia, like we know anesthesia can cause harm, right? But it still saves lives because it enables us to do really difficult surgeries. Therapy seems to have this like untouchable reputation. Like it's only good. Everyone should go to therapy. There's no negative side effects. But this Patihis study and other studies coming out are showing that therapy can do more harm than good. And I did a post that kind of went, well, it went viral on family estrangement. So family estrangement is at record high. So children, adult children cutting off their parents. And at the same time, we're seeing a huge rise in therapy. Now in the US, like a quarter of people are in therapy. And I think it's, yeah, it's like 24% of people are in therapy and 26% of people are now estranged from one or both of their parents. And I think that this is because of therapy reframing the past. It's making people think their childhoods were worse than it was. And then they are thinking, oh, I need to cut off my parents. As well, a lot of therapists are telling these adult children to cut off their parents. And I've had a lot of comments and criticism saying like, no good therapist would ever tell someone to cut off their parents. Fine. That doesn't mean therapists aren't telling children to cut off their parents, because dozens and dozens of people are commenting, this exact same thing happened to me. My therapist told me to cut off my parents. My therapist blamed my parents when I realized that I was the problem. And similarly, people are messaging me being like, my sister's always been a problem. She falls out with everyone. Now she's gone to therapy and she's cut off my parents, when my parents are completely reasonable people. And yeah, it's like the standards for what are classified as like abuse and grounds for estrangement have been lowered so much that people are cutting off families, and it's causing all sorts of problems for parents. So loads of parents are messaging me being like, my child cut me off. I don't understand. I asked them what's going on. They said, you know, don't contact me. They started therapy and now I'm an abuser. Now I'm neglectful. I don't know what I did. I don't think I did anything abusive. So yeah, there's a lot of like fallout for this from this. And I think, you know, family is one of the biggest buffers against mental health, right? We've lost a lot of buffers to anxiety. In the past, we would have things like religion. We would have community. We would have closer bonds with our friends. We'd have closer bonds with our family. Yes, at times we would have, you know, big fallouts and big arguments with our family. But when times get tough, that's when you need your family most. And if you've estranged them, you don't have that buffer anymore. One other thing to add is like, a fair criticism on my post is like, well, this generation are just no longer prepared to accept abuse. True, right? Lots of children get abused by abusive parents. And those probably are good grounds to cut off their parents. What I'm talking about is probably a small section of the people who are estranging their parents. Probably it's not the majority. The majority of people estranging their parents are probably being legitimately abused and are safer and better off without their parents in their life. I'm talking about the people who are wrongfully estranging their parents because therapy has distorted their memories.
Yeah, it's such an interesting one, because as you said, therapy for so long has kind of been like the golden goose when it comes to, you know, any sort of mental health issues. It's like, oh, well, you just need to go to therapy. Coming back to what you said at the very start of the episode. And I think it's like, I can't think of the correct word, but scapegoat comes to mind. Like it's so easy, especially for the whole like men thing. It's like there's this whole movement is, oh, men need to go to therapy. Men need to go to therapy. And on, like, quite honestly, you are the first person that I've seen on kind of Instagram and stuff and actually like calling out and being like, and also from an evidence backed perspective as well, not just like you're not kind of doing an Andrew Tate and just trying to stir the hornet's nest or anything. Like you're genuinely like, no, like this is coming from a place of like this is not working for men. With that in mind, then you kind of briefly mentioned breath work. I know that's a huge part of, you know, what you do and things. What can, you know, if men, whether they're like myself and they've tried therapy, and I'm not saying it didn't work for me, but I just got to the point where I was like, I felt like it kind of ran its course quite naturally and it got me through the point that I needed it to get me through. And then I was like, kind of ready to go out there on my own and kind of deal with this. Or whether they've just realized it's not for them and they want to do something else. Where's some kind of easy places to start with breath work, you know, both for performance, but also for a kind of coping strategy?
Yeah. So I just finish off on therapy as well, just sure, by saying please. Therapy is good, right? Majority of therapists are great people. They're smart people. They're well-intentioned people, but they're human and they have limitations. And so, you know, some people say, like, you know, criticize me because like they're saying we need to colonialize therapy, but therapy has never been colonialized. Therapy has always been like a left wing, or not necessarily left wing, but certainly left of center dominated ideology. Mm-hmm. And it's always been like, it's never been colonized. We don't need to make it extremely progressive. We don't need to make it extremely left wing. It doesn't need to be any more left than it already is. But a lot of therapists go to university, certainly in the US, that are extreme left, extreme progressive. And they have this ideology that the family is not important. But we know that family is important, right? Because when you look at the statistics in the US, a boy is now more likely to, from a broken family, is more likely to be in jail than graduate from college. So intact families do better. And I can't remember who this was, but someone, a guy was saying, like, he went to Yale and everyone there was being like, you know, families don't matter, you know, single parents are the champions of society. But then looking around, it's like 90% of these kids came from intact families. It was like these upper middle class people have these ideas. So it's like, you know, live right, talk left. They talk left, but they're living the ideals of like family really matters. And all these people were really successful, partly because they came from intact families. And there's a similar statistic, like there's never been an NFL winning quarterback who hasn't had both parents. Like, wow. Having both parents is a real privilege, right? There's that book, The Two Parent Privilege. And so with these left-wing ideologies, left of center ideologies, a lot of therapists have those ingrained, and then they're projecting them onto their clients without really realizing that they're actually harming that person's chances of success and harming their mental health. So that is why I think breathwork has the advantage, is because you're not really doing any talking. You're not like at the whims of a guru who's going to tell you, you know, whatever they are politically. They're not going to like influence you in that way. So there's lots of different types of breath work. So the one I did my PhD study on is called conscious connected breathing. So that's an umbrella term for like a kind of therapeutic breath work that puts you into an altered state, a non-ordinary state of consciousness. Some people call it a breathwork ceremony because you're doing it in like a sacred setting. You have evocative music. Often it's done in groups. I do it one-to-one, mostly with people on Zoom, because that's how I did my study. And you're going into this, doing this breathwork technique for like 40 minutes to 3 hours, depending on the practitioner. And in that state, all sorts of things are happening in the body. So mystical experiences, I mentioned that earlier. So one study by Ayerman, it was a MAPS bulletin, found that 80% of people who did conscious connected breath work had a mystical experience at some point over the course of this 11-year study. And that was done with 13,000 people. Another study by Puente 2014 found that 10% of people doing conscious connected breathwork had a complete mystical experience. And that compares to 11% of people who have complete mystical experiences on psilocybin mushrooms. So mystical experiences can be things like meeting God, meeting your deceased sister, having an experience of universal consciousness, having an experience of complete oneness, complete bliss, complete understanding and connection to all beings. And those mystical experiences are not just like, oh, cool, you know, I watched a movie and I saw this really cool thing and that was it. It's not just like watching a movie in your brain. It leads to improvements in mental health outcomes. And I love talking about outcomes because mechanisms, there's so many mechanisms going on in everything, especially conscious connected breathwork. So there's a study by Martha Havanith, who I'm having on my podcast coming up soon. She's a researcher from a German university. They did a study where they had people doing conscious connected breathwork. They measured their mental health before, and they also measured the depth of their altered state. So they went every 15 minutes, they checked in with the participants and asked them to rate how altered they were on a scale of 1 to 5 using their hands. And then they, after the study was done, they remeasured their mental health outcomes. And they found a direct correlation between how deep someone was, how altered their consciousness was, and how great an improvement they had in mental health outcomes. So, that's just one mechanism. We can also talk about nervous system stuff and emotion regulation and emotional release and things like that that also happens in conscious connected breathwork. But I'll pause there.
No, I think that's really interesting. And I think it's one of those things, again, I think especially over the last couple of years, like breath work has also kind of become one of those golden geese. I'll keep running with it, from earlier on, therapy and things. But, breath work is kind of another one of those things, especially among us like podcast bros and, things like that. And, it has become such a huge thing. But I think for good reason. I've not necessarily delved into it too much. So for clarity, me and Emmett, so Emmett's the founder of Pit Stop, me and him went to a men's retreat at the end of February, start of March in Ireland, in the Wicklow Mountains. And a huge part of that was breath work. And we did some psychedelics as well and kind of sat there and did all this breath work. And it was pretty transformative for me. I didn't come out. I think a lot of the time people, think of the word transformative and they think it's like, you're literally like Optimus Prime and you go in a truck and you come out of a robot. It's not that. It's much more subtle than that. I kind of came out and was it really affected me, especially the following week or two afterwards. I felt really different about my entire surrounding. I kind of flew back home to where I live, and I kind of viewed things very differently. And it's definitely changed me a bit. And if I'm perfectly honest, I haven't kept up with breathwork practices and things like that, other than I'll do box breathing throughout the day and things like that. But it certainly had a fundamental effect on it. And the way I interacted with others afterwards, and I sent a lot of people quite a few messages and things like that. And I suppose the word is clarity. Is what it provided me was that, and that was the most effective thing. And if I'm honest, and this is not me just hoping that I can sing from the same hymn sheet as you, but however many months of therapy I did not give me that. It didn't. And it wasn't, I'll preface this and say the breath work we did, it wasn't hugely complicated or intense or, we're going to do three kind of short inhales and then you're going to hold and then you're going to belly breathe and all this. It was very much like all of us kind of lying down in a room and there was, kind of peaceful music and setting a scene and creating an environment where, and then he'd be, right, 20 deep breaths and everyone kind of just these huge big exhales. And it had a really, really big effect. I realize I'm probably coming across as a bit of a dumbass, but I can only speak about my own experience and that's what it was. And it made a really large difference to me.
Yeah. I can give you a hypothesis for why that was. So There's a concept called the Pivotal Mental States Theory, so PIMS, and this comes from Robin Carhart-Harris, who's done a lot of the research at Imperial on psychedelics, mm-hmm. what happens during psychedelics and probably during this conscious connected breath work is you get action on the serotonin 5-2-A receptors in the brain, and this creates a really plastic state, so a state mm-hmm. where you can really change. Mm-hmm. And what's happening in sort of in evolutionary terms is like this is something that we needed for survival. So say we were, you know, living in tribes and something happens, our leader gets eaten by a saber-toothed tiger, everyone's devastated, and they realize their camp is now vulnerable. Like if you just like didn't have this pivotal mental state, you would not change, right? You would just mm-hmm. stay in that state, and then maybe the next person gets eaten by this saber-toothed tiger who now knows where you are. At times of like deep crisis, like losing a leader, losing a loved one, losing a job, we need to radically change our patterns, our habits, and our way of thinking. And this is kind of what happens with like smoking. You know, people can smoke for years and be like, oh, I know, I'm trying to quit. Then they get lung cancer and their life is under threat. And then all of a sudden they quit,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Because their life is in danger. They've entered mm-hmm. this pivotal mental state where they no longer smoke. But you can get that from psychedelics and from conscious connected breathing without the diagnosis of cancer that could probably kill you. So this is like, I think, a real advantage over talk-based therapy, because talk-based therapy, you know, you're just talking about stuff. You're not entering that pivotal mental state. You can understand mm-hmm. all the science about how smoking causes cancer, or how you need to move tribal homes, or you need to change your job, or you need to end your marriage. But just talking about things doesn't change anything. This is what Stanislav Grof said, the sort of the founder of holotropic breathwork, which is a type of conscious connected breathwork. He was like, he was like a psychoanalyst, psychiatrist. He would say, my clients could give you dissertations in their attachment disorders, in their internal family systems, in their childhood disorders. The problems didn't change. Nothing changed, despite having all this understanding. The understanding is useful, but if you actually have problems that you need to change, you need that motivation, and it's just really difficult to do it unless you get that pivotal mental state.
Yeah, absolutely. With another thing with the breath work, and something that's quite interesting, is how many of the extra bits and gadgets and, you know, optimizations should we kind of be thinking about? As I said, if I'm honest, like, I haven't, other than, you know, the kind of beyond the box breathing I've done, I haven't necessarily practiced on a daily basis, but I know, you know, certain people do. My housemate who I live with, he certainly does it kind of a bit more often than me, maybe a couple of times a week. He kind of does the Wim Hof style things. But, you know, things like having the nose strips and the mouth tape when you're going to sleep, and, you know, all that sort of stuff. There's like that Ashton guy with his like morning routine and, you know, the nose strip and all that. How important and how much onus should we put on trying to optimize all that sort of stuff?
Yeah. Well, a lot. So yeah, I'm also trained with the Oxygen Advantage, Patrick McEwen stuff. He's got a great book called The Oxygen Advantage. And this is all about optimizing our breathing and dealing with dysfunctional breathing. So there's one stat that he cites saying that 80% of people with anxiety have dysfunctional breathing. So this is another area of anxiety that just talking and is not going to solve, right? Mm-hmm. You have to start breathing functionally. So breathing functionally, you know, it obviously takes training, and, you know, I have a program to teach people how to breathe functionally, as well as, you know, doing the conscious connected stuff. But it involved nasal breathing for a start. So the nasal strips matter. There are things you can do, like, yeah, mouth taping to encourage mm-hmm. nasal breathing at night. That's not optimal for everyone. If you have like a deviated septum, or you have problems, like legitimate functional problems with your nose, mouth taping can make things worse. So make sure you can breathe through your nose before you start mouth taping. And then, yeah, for me, I have quite a narrow nose, so I do wear the nasal strips. I use the mm-hmm. intake nasal strips with the little magnet, and that helps me. Yeah, I also mouth tape at night, and that helps me stop snoring as well, and helps me stay asleep and keeps my wife happy.
That's an important one as well. Yeah, no, it's something I've been like increasingly interested in. I've got this weird thing, like my right nostril. If I like, I can't breathe properly out of it unless I like pull my cheek to the side. If I pull my cheek to the side like this, it seems to open it up, and suddenly I can breathe really well. But it's not something I've necessarily experimented with. But certainly the nasal strips have been something I've been thinking about. I probably wouldn't go down the mouth tape thing because it kind of, I don't know, it feels like claustrophobic in a weird way. I feel like I'd be really uncomfortable initially.
Yeah, I thought that. But for me now, it's like wearing a seatbelt. So like if I get in a car, I don't feel comfortable without the seatbelt.
Yeah, of course.
And now I don't feel comfortable going to sleep without the mouth tape.
That's interesting. Yeah, I suppose it's like any other habit, right? It's just something you've got to kind of, get used to.
Yeah.
So to kind of finish up, we have something called the final lap. So it's six kind of quick fire questions to ask you, one for each aspect of what we call the wheel of life. So health, mindset, leisure, relationships, career, and finance. So we kind of believe if you independently work on each of these aspects of your life, usually that leads to a pretty fulfilling existence. You don't need to do it all at the same time, but you know, usually focusing on one, and it tends to kind of go down and you know, bleed into the other aspects. So kick it off with health first. What are three simple things that you do each day to improve your health?
I walk my dog. So I live near a trail. So I get out in nature, try and get as much sunlight on my body. I do wear a hat to protect my skin from aging. But I'll be walking along the trail shirtless out here, sucking up the vitamin D. I go to the gym. I do CrossFit. I compete in CrossFit, and I go and I hang out with my friends there. So I'm getting the benefit of some meaning and purpose because I'm, you know, training for a competition. I'm also getting the benefits of exercise, and I've got a great community there. That's why I'm a CrossFit cult advocate. Another thing I do is, saunas and ice baths. Yes, certainly got, you know, it's very privileged to have those types of things. I think cold is such a wonderful tool that is accessible to anyone with a shower. Certainly in England, the showers are cold enough to get in and get the benefits. And now you can even get like a £20 net that you would just put over your shower head and put some ice cubes in, and that makes it even colder. So you don't need to buy, the Monk is my favorite ice bath, MONK. They're obviously a few grand, but if you want to invest, that's one I would recommend. But if you don't want to invest and you just want to spend £20, buy one of those nets off Amazon.
Yeah, those are solid ones. Yeah, our CEO Richie, he's obsessed with CrossFit as well. We had a guy on the podcast called Kevin Coster, who's like the world champion above 55, I think, or something like that. He's an absolute machine. But it was cool to kind of see into that world. It's not part of me. And as you can see, I definitely haven't been wearing a hat when I've been surfing because I'm pretty sunburnt. Next up, mindset. What is one piece of advice that you would give to someone to improve their mental fitness?
I think seek challenge, you know, seek discomfort. You know, discomfort's either coming for you. You can either embrace it or you can run from it, and you're much better off just increasing your tolerance to struggle rather than avoiding it. So yeah, doing things like masogis, doing ice baths, doing breath holds, those types of things.
Yeah. Doing hard things. Ross Edgley says your daily dose of discomfort.
Yeah.
And I like that. Leisure. What does taking time out just for you look like?
I'm a big dog person. Love my dog. I've got an Australian Shepherd dog. And
beautiful.
Yeah. I mean, that was, you know, I just love petting her, and you know, it's like she's really fluffy, and I love the way she smells, and like just really like engaging in the sensory experience of my dog, this thing that just loves me so much, is extremely protective, barks at absolutely everything, wants to be with me all the time, is just excited by everything, and just really like being present with her is just whenever I'm stressed, you know, I'm getting too many comments on Instagram, people are stealing my stuff on Instagram, I just go and play with my dog, and I let my face.
Love that. Leads nicely into the next one. Relationships. What's one piece of advice that you'd give to maintain good relationships in life?
I think having difficult conversations, you know, rather than just ghosting people, I think being able to approach people, have the conversations in the right way, using I statements instead of blaming. So, you know, if you say like, you've done all this, you know, you can say, I felt sad when this happened. And
right.
Yeah, taking ownership for your part. Of course, in every conflict, there's going to be two sides of the story. Probably you did something wrong. Probably the other person did something wrong, and accepting, yeah, your part, as well as being willing to accept the other person's opinion.
Love that. Career. What is one thing that you could attribute your career success to?
Being obsessive. You know, some people say that it's like a personality default. You know, some people would say like they would want to like iron this out of me. Like when I was trying to get into men's health, I was obsessive, right? I was going to the gym when all my other friends were going out drinking and going to restaurants and things like that. And then now just being obsessive, I'm reading all the time, I'm learning, I'm just really interested in stuff. And I've trained myself to be interested in stuff that's useful, instead of just like when I was younger, I would just read about Chelsea. I would just spend all my time on Football 365. And I'm just like, that's not really that useful. Let's spend time, you know, reading an academic journal, reading someone's Substack or something like that.
Love that. And then finally, finance. What's the best way to make your money work for you?
I think delaying gratification is really important. I can remember an ex-girlfriend, like, she wouldn't understand that I like got a kick out of saving. Like, ever since I was a kid, I would like, you know, I'd have my piggy bank with coins, like pennies, and I would count them every month, and I'd see how much I'd gained from doing my chores and things like that, and jobs for my parents. But I think some people are like, their ego is tied to like how much revenue they have. But actually, I get a lot of like satisfaction from growing savings, and from when I was on a salary, like 10% would immediately go into my pension, 10% would immediately go into a bank account, and then 10% would go into an ETF tracker. So automating savings takes away a lot of that willpower, and then just like never outspending my debts, never getting into debt. Like I would just be like, if I wanted something, I would save for it instead of taking out credit for it. And it's just a much better financial decision, because you're not paying 18% interest on that credit. You're saving money with your interest rate.
Yeah, I like that. Delay gratification is a good one. We've not heard that. Yeah, that's I like that. Richard, I really appreciate this. Like, there's been so much value, so much insight. It's really cool to get a bit of a different perspective, especially about the therapy thing. I think there's going to be a lot of people that will really kind of relate to that and feel quite seen, feel quite heard. You know, a lot, as you said, a lot of men clearly aren't necessarily having a great experience with this. So it's been really cool to kind of have that validated a bit. Where can people go if they want to hear more about you and what you get up to?
Yeah, so Instagram at The Breath Geek, Runga Radio is the name of our podcast, RUNGA.
Cool.
And then that 90-day intensive, we're about to launch this this program of transformation that includes a lot of breath work and mindset and nutrition and exercise. So that's runga.co/intensive. And you can get a 2-week free trial of that if you sign up.
Love that. Appreciate you. Thanks very much for coming on and sharing everything with us. Thank you very much to all of you guys for listening. And we will see you for the next one.